From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi told reporters she will move forward with a vote on that bipartisan infrastructure bill, you know, for roads and bridges. But several progressives in the House say they won't support it until there's an agreement on the Democrats' much larger social safety net plan for things like child care and climate change. There are still Democratic holdouts there, though, including Senator Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, who says it's too expensive but hasn't said what she would support. And some Democrats home in Arizona are not thrilled. Matthew Casey of member station KJZZ in Phoenix is here. Matthew, how much power does Senator Sinema have right now?
Well, Robin, Senator Sinema has met with the president several times this week. She's been at the White House, but you know, the national media has been trying to find out what she wants, and it's still unclear.
Yeah, she's the woman of the hour. Here's progressive Congressman Ro Khanna of California, who's not happy with all of this. He was speaking on NPR's Morning Edition today.
The president has repeatedly asked Senator Sinema, give us a number, tell us what you're for. Senator Durbin has been asking her. Senator Schumer has been asking her. As soon as she moves, everything will take place. But literally one person is holding up the entire president's agenda.
And Matthew Casey, again out there in Arizona, has she said anything about what she wants changed in the plan besides maybe the numbers?
Not here locally. She said very little. A week ago, she told the Arizona Republic, the newspaper of record here, that the social spending bill should be targeted and fiscally responsible in a way that does not increase inflation. But she wouldn't give a spending ceiling. She wouldn't say which areas of that massive social spending bill she supports and which ones she would not.
Okay, so Joe Manchin, who's also holding out, he comes from solid red West Virginia, which voted for Trump. Some people are understanding how Manchin might need to listen to his base there. But Arizona flipped blue, voted for Joe Biden in 2020. Many Democrats voted for Kyrsten Sinema. But give us some context here. Some of the frustration comes from the fact that she seems to have been different things politically over the years. Give us a sense.
That is true, Robin. She started out as a progressive associated with the Green Party and has transitioned over time into this moderate Democrat. She's carefully crafted this image. She has been clear since the start about her belief in bipartisan cooperation as the way to go. The pushback on that is that it's a way of doing things that no longer works in contemporary Washington.
Well, we know at least two Democratic PACs have launched campaigns, you know, fundraisers for a primary challenger to run against her if she doesn't vote for what's called the social infrastructure spending plan. We know she's meeting with business PACs who are writing checks for her. And we know that President Biden has said he wants to pay for this plan by raising taxes on some of those very businesses. And she has said she's against that. So some people are concerned about the connection there. She's not up for re-election until 2024. But last Saturday, the Arizona State Democratic Party passed a resolution to possibly censure her. Tell us more about that and this pressure from home.
Well, you mentioned the PACs. In the last 2 days, there have been announcements of two political action committees that are going to raise money to hopefully, well, they hope, to run a primary challenger against her. The one that came today is trying to draft Representative Ruben Gallego in the House to run against her in the primary. He's not said how he feels about this yet, so that remains to be seen. As far as the pressure, I'm not sure how much she feels it. I mean, to me, she has looked very focused on passing that bipartisan infrastructure bill she helped negotiate. And if it becomes law, that is just a huge victory for her. She can use it to continue to liken herself to a moderate conservative, Senator John McCain, somebody who's independent, has that streak to go their own way. And Senator McCain held office, was in the Senate alone for 30 years here.
Well, but he was a Republican, and he was an outcast Republican at that. Who is she thinking is her base?
I think she thinks her base is not just moderate Democrats, but independents and conservatives who are turned off by Trump. If Democrats were to lose confidence in her here, that goes to the future of the party, right? Will it stay moderate, herself, Senator Mark Kelly, Biden, all of whom won, or will they go progressive? And a lot of the progressive groups that supported Sinema in the past and are now becoming frustrated with her, preparing to campaign against her, a lot of them are Latino. And in 2020, there was a huge increase here in the number of Latino-eligible voters. So as far as the future of the party, it comes down to a few questions. What will the percentage increase be of Latino-eligible voters by 2024 when she has to run again? Mm. How many will join those progressive movements? And will they be able to swing a primary?
Matthew Casey of member station KJZZ in Phoenix, Arizona. Matthew, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
In a state where limited government is revered, the Texas legislature is taking up a slew of bills in what is now its third legislative session this year. The Republican-controlled legislature is looking at bail reform, an anti-trans bill, and this week it released the first draft of a new congressional map to redraw political boundaries. And Democrats and civil rights groups are concerned about partisan gerrymandering. Let's bring in Andrew Schneider, political reporter for Houston Public Media. Hi, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. So break this down for us. This new congressional map includes the addition of two new congressional seats. What stands out to you?
Well, a lot of what's going on here is that the Republicans in charge of the state legislature are trying to counter the effects of the state's growing, increasingly diverse population. The maps would increasingly concentrate Democratic districts in urban areas and inner ring suburbs. The suburbs farther away from urban cores would be diluted by adding them to more rural counties with a lot more Republican voters. And as for those two new seats, one of those seats would be added here in Houston and the other one would be added in Austin.
Democrats and civil rights groups are worried Republicans will use redistricting to basically decrease the political power of Black and brown people, many of whom have moved to Texas in big numbers since the last census. How could this new map potentially do that?
Well, people of color accounted for about 95% of Texas's population growth over the past decade. And yet the new map cuts the number of Hispanic majority districts from 8 to 7. It also eliminates the only Black majority district. It increases the number of Anglo majority districts from 22 to 23, and it ups the number of districts without any racial or ethnic majority from 5 to 8.
Okay, Texas lawmakers are also working on an anti-trans bill that would restrict transgender student athletes from competing on sports teams consistent with their gender identity. That bill failed in previous legislative sessions, but what are the chances of it passing now?
Well, right now the odds look like they favor the bill passing. Previously, the bill kept passing the state Senate only to die in the House. But last Friday, House Speaker Dade Phelan told an interviewer at the Texas Tribune Festival that the bill does have enough votes to pass in the lower chamber. It still needs to go through the committee process, but by Phelan's count, the bill has close to 80 co-authors, and it only needs 76 votes to pass the House.
The Texas Senate also recently passed an amendment that would allow judges to deny bail to people charged with certain violent or sexual crimes. Critics are saying this bill would put more people in jail. Can you break down the argument here?
Right. Well, it's important to remember this would actually pair with a bill that already passed during the second special session, which makes it harder for defendants charged with a violent crime to get a personal bond, particularly if they're charged with committing a crime while already out on bail. Critics are basically saying the jails are already overcrowded, largely with people who are awaiting trial on violent offenses. And if you make it more difficult or impossible to bond out ahead of trial, they're just going to be stuck behind bars until their trial date. That'll make the overcrowding worse.
Andrew, overall, Democrats have been in opposition during these legislative sessions. The session in August was upended when Democrats walked out and some left for Washington, D.C. How is that playing out right now?
Well, I think that's more or less played itself out completely. I mean, it was actually this session in July where the Democrats walked out. They came back at the one that started in August. But there doesn't seem to be any additional energy for further walkouts. They seem to have decided that they've made whatever point that they were going to make. The main legislation that they were trying to hold up, which was the omnibus elections bill, has since passed. I don't think they're going to try it again with redistricting.
Okay, taking a big picture look, this is Texas's third special session this year. Already more than 650 new bills have gone into effect there, including the highly controversial abortion law. This is a state that prides itself on less government. I mean, the legislature typically meets every other year. What is the larger picture here behind this approach by Republicans?
Well, as long as I've been covering Texas government, the Republican approach has not meant so much anti-government as pro-state government. The Texas Republican Party has no problem asserting the power of the state against Democratic political entities, whether that means upwards against the federal government under the Biden administration or before it under the Obama administration, or downward against the large cities and urban counties, most of which in Texas are run by Democrats. So this is simply more of the same pattern that we've seen building over the last several years.
Andrew Schneider is a political reporter for Houston Public Media. Andrew, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Millions of Americans cannot escape the dangerous impacts of wildfire smoke. That's one of the key findings of a new investigation from our California Newsroom collaboration. Those living in some of the smokiest regions are fed up with this reality, like 61-year-old Tim Pedroso, a third-generation dairy farmer in the small town of Orland, California.
We're probably going to move out of the area because we're kind of exhausted.
But it doesn't matter if you live in the West, like Pedroso, or try to move as far away as Philadelphia. The number of days cities across the country are facing air pollution from fires has gone up dramatically and often goes unnoticed. Let's now bring in Kaylee Wells, a reporter at KCRW in Los Angeles. She was part of the team working on this investigation. Kaylee, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Your findings are pretty remarkable. Tell us more about what your team found about the spread of wildfire smoke from California to basically the rest of the country.
Pretty much everywhere. That's the main takeaway. Fires are worse in California, but the smoke isn't just a Californian problem. So we're seeing in LA, where I am, for example, the number of days with smoky air has tripled. So now I'm breathing about a month's worth of smoky days. In Northern California, it's more like 2 months of smoke. But the effects aren't escapable. It's up 69% in Denver, 54% in Boston. Even D.C. is seeing 20 days of smoke on average. So it's pretty hard to escape no matter where you are in the country.
I mean, this is the million-dollar question, but what kind of impact does all of this smoke have on communities?
It's everything from things like headaches or feeling like your allergies are worse or that your lungs burn while you're running, to the mental health effects of being stuck inside, maybe, because you are trying to avoid smoke on some of the worst days. And then, you know, here in California, we also have a huge agricultural industry, and the smoke isn't good news for crops. Or Pedroso, who you just heard from, has a problem with his dairy cows getting sick. And then, you know, I remember growing up having indoor recess on really smoky days, and that was pretty novel for me. But Californian students now, that's just sort of part of reality here.
Your colleagues also spoke with Brett Brown, a physician's assistant who regularly treats patients at Glenn Medical Center. That's a small hospital in Willows, California. Let's listen.
It's been affecting a lot of our patients around here with asthma or COPD. People who normally don't get really sick are having longer and longer episodes of asthma after a cold, or just coming and complaining of terrible headaches. If they usually have migraines, they're worse.
Brown also has asthma himself, so he knows this struggle personally. You've really laid out for us some of the challenges that people are having, but what else did you learn about health impacts from exposure to wildfire smoke?
Yeah, so we did. We looked at some of the data on that too, and as smoky days increased, so did hospitalizations for respiratory and cardiac illnesses. Obviously, with the pandemic, those numbers would have been skewed if we kept 2020. But if you compare 2016 to 2018, in California, hospital admissions for those conditions went up by 30,000. And then if you look nationwide, the federally funded albuterol prescriptions, which is the kind of stuff you take if you have something like asthma, there were 240,000 more of those in 2018 than 5 years before, which, by the way, cost taxpayers another $34 million. So it's not just anecdotal evidence. We're starting to see this in the data and in the cost to taxpayers, too.
What can people actually do to protect themselves from this smoke?
Well, step one is paying attention to the air quality in your neighborhood. I do that every day when I wake up. If it's a bad day, you then can close the doors and windows. That alone can actually cut down on the smoke even by as much as half. If you can afford an air purifier, you could just pick a room, close the door, turn on the purifier, and camp out in there on smoky days. If you don't and you have air conditioning, that system can filter air. And if you don't have either of those, even just buying a box fan, taping a filter to it, and running that indoors can help some. So there are things you can do, even as the smoke gets worse, to protect your health at least somewhat.
And the reality is that, I mean, climate change plays a huge role in all of this. And since we know that climate change is not going away, we're seeing and continue to see worsening fires in these areas in Southern California. Would you recommend those who live on the other side of the country to also check air quality? I mean, we're talking about folks being able to feel it as far away as Philadelphia and Boston.
I think that's absolutely a great move. Yes, it has changed. The amount that it has changed is different depending on where you live. But across the country, we've seen it increase somewhat. And so there's certainly no harm in just making that be a part of your day, checking the air quality, and then taking some of those steps that we talked about to protect your health better.
What are some of the bigger solutions to all of this? I mean, we've talked about forest management in the past as a way to lessen the impact of wildfires. What do you feel state and federal leaders need to consider right now?
This is a tough one because you're right, climate change is continuing. We keep breaking fire records. The smoke isn't going anywhere. And yes, we have talked about, depending on where you are, especially in Northern California, that we haven't been doing as many prescribed burns as we've planned. But then there's also something to consider, like, for example, many of these fires are sparked by downed power lines, including the deadly Camp Fire in 2018 and the Dixie Fire this year, which has burned about 1 million acres. And so that feels preventable too, but it's becoming such a large issue, and to think of just one solution that could solve it, I don't think it's going to be that simple. So I think it's going to be a difficult years-long process to figure out what we're going to need to do in order to at least mitigate the effects of the smoke.
Kaylee Wells is a reporter at KCRW in Los Angeles. Kaylee, thank you so much for your reporting.
Thank you.
Well, we've spoken here to Black men about running, one running because he didn't see anyone else who looked like him running. Well, now there's actually a national organization called Black Men Running to encourage health and wellness in Black men running to stay fit. Judith Kogan with member station GBH spent some time with members of the Boston chapter and has this story.
It's a glorious Saturday morning, and about 10 Black men in running clothes are sweating and hugging, breaking their victory embraces to urge the next runner up the punishing final hill.
Let's go, Black men! Let's go! I see you, Los! Come on, Carlos!
The Boston chapter of Black Men Run organized in the wake of the murder of George Floyd. Every Saturday at 8 a.m., the runners gather to connect both spiritually and physically. They're a mix of ethnicity, religious and political leanings, and sexual orientation. But those differences are irrelevant in a world that often sees them merely as Black men.
How special could it be if, as Black men, we have a space to just come and just be?
Group leader Jeff Davis is thinking about the killing of Black men by police or through violence.
Because those moments are going to happen again. We're going to get triggered on a daily. But if you can come and have this experience and be connected with other brothers, right?
A runner since high school, Davis realized that a running group could bolster physical and mental health while creating community.
Rotate your shoulders. Put a little bit more pep in your step.
At the start of each session, Davis leads the men through warm-up exercises. Then they circle up, and each answers the question, why? Why did you show up today?
The love of our community.
For continued balance.
Being here for those that can't be at the circle with us.
Being consistent.
Black excellence. So much joy and pride.
Lifting one another up in love and peace.
Some of the men have been running all their lives. Others are novices. Today they'll be covering 4 miles, but they know it's okay to jog, even walk the route.
We're going to start up Talbot. We're going to take Talbot, Norfolk, over to onto Morton.
Everyone waits at the finish line for the last to return.
Idris! Idris, finish strong! Finish strong, let's go! Woo! We don't quit! We don't quit!
Davis says running often brings up difficult dormant emotions. Thoughts suppressed for years may start to surface.
You might not even know the emotions are coming if you're a new runner. You don't know. But you get out there 1 mile, 2 mile, 3 mile, 5 mile, I gotta get to the finish line. But then after that, all the dormant emotions hit you. And in that moment, can you have a brother hold you up?
Look at me! Come get your brothers, baby!
Runner Khalil Sadiq says life at the moment is fraught.
We're still very much living in an age of two pandemics, the pandemic of COVID-19 and, of course, racism.
Sergino Renee says he runs for his mental health. He says that as a Black man, he's lucky to have a good job and a home in a nice neighborhood. But he lives with microaggressions on a daily basis.
These guys have all been through those experiences as well. There's just that understanding of, I know where you're at.
And they're all here for the physical fitness, including Nigerian-born Robin Otu, whose overnight job means he hasn't slept since yesterday afternoon.
Actually, when I first started, I couldn't run half a mile. Once you're consistent with it, it really, really got me in shape.
Hoping to lead by example, the group intentionally runs through Black neighborhoods. Almost 50% of Black men over 20 suffer from cardiac disease. A quarter of them will die from it. Here's Jeff Davis again.
As a community member, I want to show that health and wellness is not a fantasy. It's actually a lifestyle that anyone can achieve. It just takes one step at a time.
And today, as the last of the runners pulls up to the finish line, those accumulated steps energize a euphoric brotherhood. For Here and Now, I'm Judith Kogan.
What do you say, Idris? You already won, baby! You already won, Idris! Come on! Come on, give me! Heads up!
In Turkey, there's growing concern over President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's latest push to control the media. It was social media reaction to a recent event in the Erdogan family that has him talking about new restrictions. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
In July, Erdogan told a gathering of ruling party officials that social media channels were out of control. He called it imperative that channels where, quote, lies, slander, and attacks on personal rights take place should be brought to order.
Such channels do not suit this nation. Therefore, we want to bring these subjects to our parliament and tell them we want such social media channels to be completely removed or controlled.
Erdogan has a personal reason for wanting to rein in social media. In June, his son-in-law, Turkey's finance minister, had posted a tweet celebrating the birth of his fourth child, Erdogan's grandchild. The post was met with a wave of negative and insulting responses on social media. Erdogan called it social media terror.
When the legal regulation is completed, we will put into effect all kinds of methods, including access barriers and judicial and financial sanctions. Turkey is not a banana republic.
Erdogan has already banned Twitter and YouTube, though they were later reinstated. With the parliament returning to session, media advocates are worried about what kind of barriers Erdogan has in mind now. Gürkan Özturan with the European Center for Press and Media Freedom follows digital rights and liberties issues in Turkey.
We have been seeing that the government has been increasing its crackdown on the internet, and not only the internet, but all kinds of platforms that enabled the society to access to crucial information.
Turkey already has a media law that it's used to block hundreds of thousands of items online. Özturan says, to no one's surprise, the government calls to remove online content haven't targeted pro-government comments.
It has always been the ones that are either critical of the government or the content revealing claims of corruption.
The new move to control social media posts has drawn concern among some Turkish business people as well. Usal Shabaz is a business consultant who's been following this issue. He says the government is keeping details of the new law confidential until a proposal is made public. But what he's hearing from sources in the ruling party suggests that this new crackdown may not apply simply to social media platforms, but to individual users as well.
It is also possible that the responsibility may go beyond tweeting something, but also may include retweeting something, spreading false information without knowing whether it is false or not. This is more restrictive than last year's law, and it may also result in a lot of self-censorship on behalf of the users.
He says self-censorship is already happening in Turkey and could get much worse. Some are concerned that repression of dissenting voices on social media will ramp up ahead of the next presidential election. Shabazz says personally he thinks if the government is going to regulate social media, political advertising is one area it should look at.
Who is financing them? The transparency of whether it's an ad or it's not a sponsored content. These type of things are much more important than false news and all these type of, you know, regulation discussions that we are currently having.
The government appears to be hearing the criticism. Erdogan's justice minister recently said the ruling party has no intention of restricting free expression and the government won't stand for censorship. For now, all sides are waiting to see the details, to learn in the coming weeks what exactly the government does have in mind when it comes to social media. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Istanbul.
Tomorrow's October 1st, lots of deadlines as we're reporting today. But did you know flood insurance rates go up starting tomorrow? That's because the government has subsidized flood insurance for people living along the coast since the 1960s, and that's ending. What FEMA, which runs the program, is trying to do is make flood insurance rates reflect the reality of climate change, maybe get homeowners to move to safer ground, but also phase out this current system, which ends up subsidizing people who own big houses on the seashore rather than the less well-off in flood zones inland. Roy White used to run the flood insurance program at FEMA. He now runs the research group, the Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety. So, Roy, first, do you agree things had to change?
They were long overdue. FEMA's been running an antiquated approach that was built in the 1980s. And while it's taken a little too long to get here, over the last 4 years, FEMA has put in something that is sound, uses great science, and really just reflects the way the rest of the property insurance work underwrites this kind of risk.
Okay, so let's explain. First of all, tomorrow, October 1st, if you're about to buy a home that needs flood insurance, your rates are going to be higher. If you already own a home that has flood insurance that's subsidized, that'll start going up starting in April, and it'll be phased up. But, you know, these rates are going to go up maybe $120 for some people the first year. It could be over $1,000 the first year, and then they might continue to go up because they're based on the size of the home. It used to be just whether a home was on a flood map and other things. You wanted to talk about how this will be more equitable. How so?
It is. There are really three groups that are going to be impacted by risk rating 2.0, this new approach that FEMA is taking. You highlighted the 10 to 12% of people who are going to see a new target rate that they're going to have to stepwise into over the next 5 to 7 years.
The government is letting people know, here's how high this could go. So starting tomorrow, if you buy a new home, you're going to pay that full targeted rate. But if you're a current homeowner, that's only going to be phased in starting in the spring, correct? And you can't do more than, I think, 18% a year. You can't, by law, can't raise somebody's coverage by more than 18% a year?
You can't raise that price by more than 18% a year. So yes.
Yeah, okay.
There's about 60 or 65% of folks who will see small increases to their flood insurance premiums, but it's the same increase they would have received in any other prior year, 5 to 9% a year. The cost of construction's gone up, that's reflected. But there's a group of about 25% of folks. These are middle-income folks. There's 1.2 million families in this group that are going to see a price reduction. Because as you said, in the past, you know, every home who got $250,000 worth of cover paid the same. And now FEMA is beginning to differentiate flood frequency, multiple floods, the distance to the flooding source, and the cost to rebuild. $1 million home costs a lot more to rebuild when it has a small damage than a home that only costs $200,000. That is now reflected.
So you say it's more equitable because these are people who are sometimes more inland, and yet we're flooding inland now, and they had smaller homes. And yet they were getting subsidized the same way a mansion, which might be a second home right on the ocean, mm-hmm. was getting subsidized. Those mansions are going to have to pay more. However, there are people caught up in this in small coastal neighborhoods in Florida, for instance. We're hearing from homeowners who are saying, this was my retirement home. I'm not rich. And we're hearing of, let's say, one homeowner who might have to pay $6,000 a year eventually for her flood insurance. You know, this was supposed to be her dream retirement home, and she's not wealthy. Is it going to be too punitive?
Robin, there are real impacts on families and their budgets, and that is not lost on me. I don't think it's lost at anyone at FEMA or in the insurance world. But we talk a lot about climate change, and frankly, there's far less debate about the severity and frequency of events and how that ties to climate change. But there's a price for that. As that risk has gone up, it is not free.
Yeah.
And so for those who have the ability to pay, they should pay their fair share. For those who can't, I think Congress needs to look at ways to assist with affordability.
Well, there's been a last-minute push by some lawmakers to actually stop the rate increases. And you know the real estate industry has beat back previous attempts. Do you think it's going to stick this time around?
I hope so. And I think one of the reasons that I am optimistic this can move forward is because there are those 1.2 million families who have frankly been paying an extra tax to depress the insurance premiums of those with higher value homes.
Right.
Now, might Congress put a limit and say, don't raise someone 18% a year over year, maybe pull that down to 12% or pull that down to 9%. Congress can do that, and maybe they should do that.
Roy Wright is the former chief executive of the National Flood Insurance Program at FEMA, which is being revamped. The government is no longer going to be subsidizing the flood insurance for people who live in coastal areas, and that's going to be phased out starting tomorrow. Roy, thank you.
Thank you.
Ski resorts are now struggling to find employees, and yes, we're not that far away from ski season. Finding people to fill these jobs has been a problem for years in resort towns, but the pandemic has made it much worse. Nina Keck of Vermont Public Radio reports.
Mike Salamano walks through a room full of mountain bikes and greets rental shop employees.
What's going on?
Oh, not too much yet.
How was this weekend?
Mellow.
Salamano is president of Killington and Pico Ski Resorts. Last year, he was worried about just being able to open. This year, his biggest headache is staffing.
It's pretty much all we talk about. But it's depressing. You go to job fairs in town and two or three people show up.
Vermont's unemployment rate is just 3%. And since the pandemic, the state's workforce has shrunk by nearly 30,000 people. Some aren't working because of health concerns. Others lack childcare or are just plain burned out. Many others have chosen now to retire. The situation has forced Salamano, like many in the industry, to prioritize. This summer, for instance, weddings and mountain biking got staffed, but the resort's popular ropes course, zip line, and roller coaster were only open on weekends. He says they've invested millions in technology to automate what they can. But come winter, ski areas still need hundreds more people. Everyone from lift operators and snowmakers to trail groomers, parking attendants, and folks to dish up hot soup.
It's a bit of a reckoning in the resort industry.
Adrienne Saya Isaac is with the National Ski Areas Association in Colorado. She says resorts nationwide are offering seasonal workers everything from signing bonuses and paid time off to discounted childcare and more flexible schedules.
Vail Resorts, the largest ski area operator in North America, has bumped up the starting wage to $15 in many of their mountain communities where the cost of living is higher.
Whether resorts will be able to hire foreign workers, seasonal staff many ski areas have relied on for years, remains unclear because of vaccination and border issues. What is clear is everyone in the industry will need to adapt. Ski lodges will likely offer more grab-and-go foods, while restaurants may cut back on the number of meals they serve or remove tables. Hotels may take rooms offline. Molly Mahar, president of the Vermont Ski Areas Association, says cross-training will be key.
Say you work in accounting or in the marketing department, you might be trained to fit ski boots at the rental shop, and then you might go to the cafeteria and scoop soup or make sandwiches or run a cash register.
This time of year, cyclists are using the chairlifts at Killington instead of skiers. Chris Carter teaches mountain biking at the resort. While everyone appreciates higher pay, he says professional development for staff can be equally important. For instance, he says Killington paid for his instructor certification training, and now he's helping train newer staff.
Yeah, it definitely helps bringing people back from season to season. And somebody who gets their certification through here at the Hill, they're like, oh, this is my home. This is now the place where I'm going to spend my time. So it made the difference for me this season as well.
That's important, because while it's critical resorts attract new employees, they can't afford to lose the ones they already have. For NPR News, I'm Nina Keck in Chittenden, Vermont.
Yes, this is a really big news day. We're watching the running around and bargaining on Capitol Hill over bills and funding the government, but we need our energy to do that. So fasten your Bugs Bunny ears. What, you don't have a pair for Easter church service? Because here and now, resident chef Kathy Gunst wants to talk carrots. So Kathy, watch what I'm going to do here. What's up?
Well, hi there. Yeah, they are a great source of energy. They're actually great for almost anything from soup to nuts, and we're going to get into that.
Wait, did you miss my Bugs Bunny reference? What's up?
Yeah, I forgot to laugh. I'm sorry.
That's all right. Anyway, so is it still carrot season? I'm seeing them at farmers markets, so I assume.
Very much carrot season. Yeah. This is the time of year when they are still underground, and they are getting sweeter and sweeter. In fact, right now is when they're harvested and kept through the winter, and they are just prime. And I would say farmers markets is a great place to look for carrots and also to look for different varieties.
Well, do the different colors that we see now, you know, white and purple, do they have a different flavor?
They do, but it's very subtle. Purple carrots are slightly peppery. They're also sweet. They're great in pickles. Red carrots have an antioxidant that makes them red. They're great in soups and salads. There's white ones, golden yellow ones. The story goes that carrots used to all be these other colors, and in the 17th century, Dutch farmers cultivated orange carrots as a tribute to William of Orange, who led the struggle for Dutch. So orange carrots are a fairly new phenomenon.
Well, I'm so sorry. I apologize for the Dutch in my background. Well, let's start with your soup recipe, because it's just getting to be that time of year in parts of the country. You have one, carrots and a lot of ginger.
Yes, this is one of my absolute favorite soups. Carrots and ginger are good friends. Mm. This is a soup where you roast big chunks of carrot and some red onions, a little bit of olive oil till they're just tender and slightly smoky. And while that mixture is roasting, you simmer some fresh ginger in vegetable broth. Mm. You then make, this is the really interesting part, a cup of ginger tea. You either have the tea or you put a knob of fresh ginger into boiling water. And you use that ginger tea to deglaze that roasting pan. Mm. The whole thing gets simmered up and pureed. And then you can even grate raw ginger on top. And oh, boy, if you have a sore throat or as the wet, colder weather comes, perfect, perfect food.
Deglaze, by the way, is a fancy word for you put some liquid in there and get all the nice chunks of stuff off the bottom of the pan.
Accurate. And use very that. Accurate, yes.
That sounds great. We're going to have everything at herenow.org. A carrot pancake recipe.
Yeah, this is a super fun recipe. This is a savory pancake. You grate carrots. You use Greek yogurt. It's got flour and baking powder, but it comes together in 5-10 minutes. And then I like to add some Middle Eastern spices, ground cumin and za'atar, which is a blend of thyme, oregano, sumac, and sesame seeds that you can find online or in grocery stores. And then you serve these pancakes with Greek yogurt, chopped parsley, really anything you want. And you can have them for breakfast, lunch, or dinner.
Yeah, it could be dinner. I'm going to bring in the well-known chef and who happens to be my partner today, Tanya Mosley.
Tanya, now that's funny.
I just always in the kitchen. but because we're going to be talking about something that everybody has questions about, it's carrot cake, which my carrot cake, Tanya, is a lot of cream cheese with a little carrot on it. I mean, talk about that, Kathy. It doesn't have to be that kind of a log of cream cheese.
No, this is maybe, I hesitate to use the word healthy, but it really is. This is a tea cake. So you make it in a bread loaf pan, and it is so easy. You mix up grated apple, grated carrots, cinnamon, ginger, allspice, raisins, and walnuts. You bake it in the loaf pan, no cream cheese. In fact, no butter at all. And then I just sprinkle confectioner's sugar on it. But if you want to get fancy, this is so much fun. You take a peeler down a big carrot and make some strips off your carrot, working from the top to the bottom. And then you boil sugar and water and throw those carrot strips in, and you get these gorgeous candied carrot strips that look so fancy, like you are the baker of bakers. And you put that over your finished.
Yeah.
Tanya, do it with your kids. It is fun. And boy,
I feel like I have to do it with the kids not in the kitchen, because we're like on the deceptively delicious train where they'll eat it if they don't know it's a vegetable.
Right.
So I like this idea.
You want to hide the carrot. Well, I say let it shine, and then they'll realize, wow, I think I love carrots.
Okay, I think that's a great plan. And by the way, the way you described that carrot cake, that's exactly how Tanya Mosley does it with the tea cake.
She does now.
but also, Tanya, right. I mean, you make a point. Getting kids to eat carrots, what a great way, with many of the things we've mentioned here, maybe steam them up a little honey on them or something. Do something different. Kathy Gunst, our resident chef. We'll have all of Kathy's carrot recipes at herenow.org. Thanks as always.
Thank you both.
And Tanya, I see you with the shaver. You know, what are those things called? A peeler. Just peeling down the carrots.
There you go, with all the different color carrots. Right. I love it.
There you go. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.